accession number 18776, reel 3.
Stuckey, reel 3.
Right, well, we were just saying the recruitment was interesting in the sense that a young officer, probably in uniform as a second lieutenant, but he would almost certainly be an assistant district officer who had experience of the country and knew the language, would be sent to go around the villages of the Northern Territories and indeed over the border into French territory in order to recruit. And he would merely go to the headman of a village and say, I'm looking for 6 soldiers from your village, how about it? And the headman would cooperate and say, yes, well, I've got some, I can recommend these chaps. They're strong, healthy, and reliable and trustworthy. And I think they would be, as it were, fitting to serve the king. And that's the way it went. And they would then take this little bunch back to the training centre, which is where we were. And they'd come in straight out of the bush, you might say. And most of these people, of course, sometimes they had Hausa as the lingua franca, because that was a trading language for northern Nigeria. They had their own, as it were, their own internal, their own family language, tribal language, but they would automatically speak Hausa at the same time. So they tended to be automatically bilingual and amazing linguists. And so most of them would have a smattering of Hausa. Some of them didn't, but if they didn't, they'd learn amazingly quickly. But they would come in, and when you consider that most of them had never seen a wheel, let alone an aeroplane or anything like that, because in their remote parts in those days, they were beyond the lorry even. So what they saw when they came in must have been an enormous revelation to them. And so something, but what one was amazed at is the speed with which they assimilated all this this new scene and got down to it. Now those are the recruits. Now on the other side, you asked about the army, then you're talking really about the NCOs, which means the lance corporals upwards, because you had in the system the lance corporals, corporals, sergeants, and the sergeant major were all Africans. But in each company, you also had a certain European element. All the officers were white men. And then you had a company sergeant major who would be from a British regiment. And you had a company quartermaster sergeant to do the administration who would also be from a British regiment. And so you would have 2 sergeant majors, in effect. You had the British company sergeant major, and then you would have the African company sergeant major. Well, now, the African could become a regimental sergeant major, one up. Of course, in each battalion had a regimental sergeant major, who was the number one. But all I can tell you is that those people who were pre-war, of course, and had been in for 10 years, 12 years, 15 years, were amazingly well-trained, actually. And what they didn't know about basic soldiering wasn't worth knowing. They'd been well trained, well disciplined, and of course they were well looked after. The army, I could say, was, get it in context, the army was a very much desired home to be in pre-war, because you got paid a shilling a day. Well, a shilling a day was quite a lot of money when the average labourer was getting about fourpence a day. So they were fairly handsomely rewarded. They were given admirable training. They were given free accommodation for them, their wives, in a little sort of bush hut in the barracks. So they had all that thrown in. They had their food, I think, was thrown in for nothing. So they were really onto a very good thing. Though their shilling a day, virtually, didn't sound very much, but it went a long way pre-war in Nigeria, and that was pocket money, effectively. But the army was an eminently desirable place to be. You had to be pretty good to be accepted. So that really led to high standards. And that's why when you saw these old African sergeants and sergeant majors, you suddenly realized that they were pretty well trained. They knew quite a lot. They'd been well looked after by the white officers and so on, trained in the past. And they carried the tradition on, so they were very good at training recruits, and they were all very upright, loyal men, and one had a considerable respect for them.
Could the recruits, could the soldiers speak any English?
No, not at all. Well, of course, Nigeria was slightly different from other colonies, I think, in that, in, if you're talking about the Gambia, or you're talking about Sierra Leone Regiment, or we're talking about Gold Coast, because of the problem, multiplicity, I suppose, of tongues in those countries, they had always worked on English as the standard language for the army. However, in Nigeria, it was different. Because the fighting soldiers all came from the north, where you had this lingua franca of Hausa, it was always the custom there to speak Hausa. So the European officer had to speak, or the European NCO for that matter, had to learn Hausa. And I actually got interested in Hausa, in fact, and I realized that I'd have to learn. If I wanted to talk to soldiers in my, initially my platoon, I was just a platoon commander, but my 20-odd soldiers, if I wanted to get across to them, I had to learn their language. So I actually went out of my way to study, and I had a very good company commander called Douglas Haig, who was a district officer, who was a chap in his 40s, and had been out there some time and knew the language and the country backwards. And he was very helpful, and gave me a Hausa dictionary and various other forms of encouragement. Anyway, I got down to spending a lot of my spare time buffing up on the language, and then I got into taking the government language exams and so on, and which are the ones that the administrative service would take. So I did some of those, and I got quite fluent. And I found it was a great help, actually, because if you had fluency and you were able to talk to your soldiers, then they had that slightly more respect for you, perhaps, than they might have had otherwise. And so I stuck up quite a good rapport. Anyhow, moving on from there, my lot changed fairly soon, because my Dougie Haig, said, well, I'm afraid I'm off in about next month. I'm going back on leave, because you had to have from that colony, because of the malaria problem. The standard peacetime tour was only 18 months. And I think if you got more senior, you were only doing 15 months. Because after that time, you had to have what was known as recuperative leave, which meant that, you know, you were a bit run down, what with malaria and one thing and another, and the climate not being too good. And so you needed to go back for, and I think you had a week in England for every month's service or something like that, so you had quite a good break. Anyway, Dougie Haig said, well, I'm going back now on leave, and I think I'm right in saying he never came back again. I don't know what happened to Dougie Haig, but he may have retired, I suppose. But so the next thing I knew was that I was being told at the age of 20 to take over command of the company. And so that was quite revealing.
What was the name of this company?
Well, I think it was A Company, if I remember. There were four companies in the battalion, as you know, and in the training battalion. But anyway, I was told to take over, and so I had to get on with it and do the best I could. And so at a young, tender age, I found myself promoted to captain and given enormous power and influence, which is quite beyond anything that anyone would ever have expected or anticipated. But on the other hand, it was a question of being thrown in the deep end and learning quickly. And because I was getting on a bit with the language, I was able to... I managed. I'm not saying I was very good at it, but I learned as best I could. And I managed, and so I had command of that company for quite some time.
Where did the soldiers come from?
The soldiers? Well, they came from the northern provinces of Nigeria, which would be Sokoto in the west, Kano. I'm talking about, these are provinces now I'm talking about, the province of Sokoto, the province of Kano, province of Katsina, and the province of Maiduguri. Some of them would come over from over the frontier into, would it be Dahomey, French West Africa. I don't know why, but there was some agreement, I suppose, we have with the French that we could recruit from their territories. And the only exception to that would tend to be the what we call the savvy boys from the south, who were tended to be things like drivers of vehicles or clerks. And they tended to be Igbos from the south of Nigeria, different race altogether, who are not really the warrior class, you might say, but nevertheless were quite good people, and they were a very cheerful lot, and were quite bright. And so your company clerk would be an African, and he would be probably trained in a mission school, as it were, and picked up his English in a mission school. And then your drivers would tend to be southerners, whereas your fighting men would all be in these northern provinces I've been talking about.
And were there any particular tribes from which they were recruited in particular?
Tribes? Well, we talk about the Hausas, but of course there's no such thing as a Hausa tribe. The Hausa is just a language, which is a trading language, really. It's a lingua franca that covers the whole of northern Nigeria, and it's used for trading purposes. And they all trade, and they're all cattlemen and horsemen. They know about horses, they know about cattle, and so on. And they trade, and they moved about quite a lot. Yes, tribes, I can say that I can't tell you, you can't put a name on them, because they were local tribes, you might say, without any special significance, with certain exceptions. We had Fulani. The Fulani, of course, were notable in that they tended to have blue eyes and very light skin, and they were a non-Negroid. Now, the other point one should make, I suppose, is that these chaps, the fighting soldiers from the north, the northern provinces I've been talking about, were non-Negroid. They all had didn't have the Negro nose and thick lips. They had rather fine features, more Nubian, more of the Nile. And they were. I have got some very good pictures, which I hope to give to the Imperial War Museum, if I can find them, of head and shoulders. We had, after the war, an artist did head and shoulder portraits of quite a number of these people, and they're extremely well done. And I've got photographs of them, and they should be preserved somewhere. However, Fulani, yes, they were a nomadic race, very much akin to the Maasai in East Africa. They were nomadic people, light-skinned, fair-haired, blue-eyed, attractive race, and they would wander about with their cattle on the move, and some of those came into the army. And then you had the Munchi. The Munchi certainly were a race identifiable. They were not Hausa-speaking, really. They came in from the Munchi districts of northern Nigeria, and they were they had these very pronounced skin markings.
Scars?
Yes, that's right. Cuts, in fact. The incisions cut when they were children, and I don't know how they managed to keep them open. They keep them open, don't they, with salt for a certain time, I think. So they have these very pronounced markings indeed. And the other thing about the Munchi was that they tended to have filed teeth, so all their teeth were pointed. But they were a cheerful lot, and they made very good soldiers, and they learnt the Hausa in the way that any African had. And I say the startling thing one did note was that the people who came in as recruits, although they couldn't, some of them couldn't speak Hausa when they came in, after about the end of the first week, they were beginning to get the hang of it. And after about a month, they were, you know, becoming quite fluent. They had an amazing year. These, of course, were people who were not literate, one should remember. And I think that had something to do with it. Because if you're not literate, you have to store it all up here, and you have to depend on your ear. And I think because they weren't used to the written word, they had this amazing ability for picking up sounds. And well, they had just had a good year, I suppose, is what you would say. So picking up another language was not too difficult. Some of them, you see, you've got to remember, had something like four languages. They'd have their own sort of little local tribal, then they'd have the tongue of the tribal lot next door, then they'd probably have Hausa for the trading, and maybe one other as well. So you would suddenly find, if you're talking to these people, they could actually converse in something like four languages. Another amusing thing, it doesn't come to me, occur to me, on the subject of languages, was that some of these chaps who came in from the French territories in fact spoke French. And you may know that the French tradition was that, unlike the British, who retired at the age of 55 and went home, and that was the end of that, and then a new generation came out, but in West Africa, at least, as opposed to East Africa, but in West Africa, the white man was non-resident. He was sent out there for his tour, and he retired at an earliest age, and that was that. Whereas the French played it differently, they were residential, and the French actually moved in, and generation after generation they tended to stay, you see. So they had this continuity, and in some ways a better system, I don't know. However, the point I'm making is that the you suddenly found that, well, you'd be told that by your platoon sergeant, shall we say, that so-and-so has come in. He doesn't speak any Hausa, but he can speak French. So I would then try my French on them. And, of course, I soon found that their French is rather better than mine, which I hadn't done for some time. But the reason it was better was that in the French colonies, the French had ordained, French is the language. And if you want to do anything in our colonies, you've jolly well got to get on top of French, and they all got the message. But what was amusing to me was that not so much that they had knowledge of the language, but also their accent, because they didn't speak provincial French at all. They spoke Parisian to my ear. Their French was absolutely spot on. In distinction, for example, when our southerners I was telling about, who came in as the drivers and the clerks and so on, they would speak what we call pidgin English, which you probably know all about, but it was a sort of thing which was, I think, promoted by the mission to some extent, the mission school, the missionary, and so on. But it was rather basic stuff, really, and it wasn't, should we say, King's English by any stretch of imagination. The French didn't play it that way at all. They said, no, French is the language, and what's more, we don't mean provincial French, we mean Parisian French. So you had these chaps straight out of the bush, not knowing anything or not having seen anything, who were suddenly speaking to you in wonderful French, which was a rather revealing experience. However,
was there any education for the soldiers?
No, not really. No, not in the sense that you mean it, I don't think. I mean, I don't know what education. I think pre-war, the families would be looked after. And if you were a soldier, should we say, doing 15 years or something, 20 years in the army, and you had your wife and children in barracks, then there'd be some little school for the army children, yes, in that sense. But by the time the war was on, of course, the families had gone, so there were nothing like that. There were no women around. And education really was limited to military subjects, if you like. I think it was a certain amount of, a bit of what you might call, what we used to call ABCA, didn't we, current affairs, where you'd be supposed to be having a little monthly or weekly talk telling them what was going on in the big world outside. But I mean
the course of the war?
Well, yes, the course of the war, exactly. And I think that was, I don't think it meant very much to them, really, but you tried to tell them that it was about the king in England and all that, how we were being bombarded and how they were doing their bit to support the king. And they got the message. They knew that much.
Did the war mean very much to them, do you think?
I think that's difficult to gauge, really. We perhaps fondly imagine that it did, but I think it did and it didn't. I think some soldiers, certainly, some of the older ones, perhaps those who'd been in, you see, those who'd been in pre-war, I think were indoctrinated for the simple reason that they'd have had, for example, on the Queen's birthday or the King's birthday parade annually, they'd have had a big parade and with a lot of pomp and ceremony and so on, and dressing up and all the rest of it. And this would be in celebration of the Sirikhi, the king in England, and his birthday. Things like that would be, I think, part of their background. So I think they would know all about it. But as the soldiers who came in to do the wartime fighting, if you like, from scratch, I don't think they understood very much about it. They probably vaguely knew that there was a king of England in the background somewhere. But, of course, in the north, you see, you've got to remember that the provinces I mentioned were, to some extent, self-governing. Because whereas in the south, in the Igbo country and the Yoruba country in the south, Nigeria, I should explain, if you don't know, is virtually, to my mind, three different countries. You have the Yoruba countryside, Yoruba country, which is all around Lagos, the Yoruba tribe basically. And then you had the Igbo tribe to the east, based on what's now the oil fields, of course. That's where the oil-rich countries, counties, areas. And then in the north, you've got these, as I said, Sokoto, you've got Kano, Katsina, Zaria, and Maiduguri provinces. And they were, to some extent, autonomous. And the administration was what they called indirect, in that the district officer, there would be assistant district officers under him, British, but at the same time there'd be a layer of administration carried out by the locals themselves. So it was indirect, as they called it. It had to be, they had to toe the party line, of course, but they nevertheless did quite a lot of administration in their own right, in their own way, and provided it coincided with our general overall political aims, it was acceptable. So we were the sort of paternalistic, people keeping an eye on things, and they were in fact doing some of the actual detail themselves, whereas in the south, of course, the whole chain of administration went down to the lowest level, entirely in the hands of the British. It's quite a difference, really. But to go back to your point, did they understand what was going on? Well, I think they understood they'd have a loyalty to the head. I mean, the emir of Zaria, or the emir of Katsina, or the emir of Sokoto would be their sort of number one, really. And they don't forget, they're all Mohammedans. So there was a religious thing there. And the emir of Sokoto was the senior, because he was a senior Muslim. So there was that kind of link, Mohammedan link, throughout all the northerners, you see, a Muslim link, which again made them a bit different from the southerner, who had no particular religion, except some of them were Christian, of course, because they'd been in the mission schools, and they'd been indoctrinated in the Christian tradition. So
were there any priests or holy men who...
Oh yes, you had, yeah, oh yes, every battalion had an imam who was a holy man, and he was the certainly that he was the priest, really. Yes, he was the you might say the equivalent of the battalion padre from a British battalion, and he would keep an eye on things and make certain they were saying their prayers on the right day. And Friday, I think it was, wasn't it? Friday was the holy day. Friday was a day off, virtually. Because that was their day of prayer. Oh yes, the imam had a certain amount of influence, not as much as he would have had in peacetime, I'm sure, but he was always there.
Did they ever come to you with problems?
Well, the imams, you mean?
No, I mean the troops.
The troops. Well, not really, in the sense that they didn't have any family problems, because their families, if they had families, they're probably youngish men without families, you see, on the whole. And the NCOs, whose families would be, I don't know where they were, they must have been in the town, I suppose. They weren't in barracks, the old soldiers, in other words. But we didn't have family problems that we knew about. And I think if there were problems, they'd have been sorted out on the African net, because don't forget, you had this strata of chain of command in each battalion. The senior African in a battalion would be the regimental sergeant major, who would be a chap with perhaps 20 years service or 25 years service, would be a very senior and experienced man. Then he'd have five or six African company sergeant majors under him, and then the sergeants, the hierarchy, the corporals, all the way down. So any sort of domestic problems of that sort would tend to be sorted out, I think, by them. So we only, I think, got involved on what you might call the disciplinary side. And if there was any indiscipline or any breach or anything like that, then of course we might get involved, or they might be formed up in the usual way and put on a charge. But it was fairly rare, actually. We didn't really have very much trouble, I'm happy to say.
Did you ever have any discipline problems with the troops?
Didn't have any discipline problems, nothing serious. Sometimes you had sort of minor things, you know, very minor.
Such as,
I'm just trying to think. Did we have perhaps maybe somebody would be a day late in coming back from a bit of leave? I think they were allowed a bit of leave occasionally, and it might be a day or two late. They'll put on a charge for being late, but it was probably no fault of theirs. I don't know. No, I think the company office, which is when you take your soldiers to task, when you have your company orders, was fairly rare.
Would you call them askaris?
We do in East Africa. It's the same thing, but they are called askaris in East Africa. We didn't call them askaris, in fact. No, that's in the Swahili term, isn't it?
Yes.
No, we didn't have that term.
You didn't have an equivalent term?
No, we were just SOJA was the word soldier. We didn't have there's no equivalent to askari in the Hausa language, I don't think. No. No.
So you're in Enugu, you're a company commander, you're a captain. What happened next? Is this 1941?
Well, I was then told that we were going to war, and this was 41. I was in 41, and then I soldiered on through 41. Yes, that's right, in my first year there. And then come the end of 42, would it be, I had to do 2 years. I was told that I think about halfway through 42, I was posted to another battalion in the north. I left Enugu, in short, and went out to a place called Maiduguri, which is the northeast frontier, which was quite interesting. And my platoon was on the airfield. My company was on the airfield. I was commanding a company then of the 12th Nigerian Regiment. I think it was 10th Battalion Nigerian Regiment. Anyway, my job as a company commander was to look after the airfield defences at Maiduguri. And the importance of Maiduguri, which is on the edge of the Sudan, was that it was on the direct supply line of aircraft to the Middle East. And what happened was that the tanker, the ships, the freighters would bring over fighter aircraft from either England or from America into Takoradi Harbour, and then they would put them ashore in pieces. They would assemble them. RAF were in Takoradi, and the RAF would assemble these aircraft, and then they would fly them over to Khartoum and Cairo. And they had to have various staging posts for refueling, of course. And one of the staging posts was, in fact, Maiduguri. And it was thought or feared that, if possible anyway, that the Germans might come over from the desert and descend on some of these, try and cut the route, in other words, because it's quite an important link, actually, because it was about the only way, I think, the reinforcement aircraft could get in. So you had these little groups of probably a dozen or 15 fighter aircraft, could be Hurricanes or Spitfires, in the case of a British convoy, RAF, or it could be they always had a queen, what we call the Queen Bee, with them, which would be a medium bomber for navigation purposes and that sort of thing. In the case of the Americans, it would be they had the American fighter, which was the bomber was the Mitchell, the B-24, I think it was called, medium bomber. That was the Queen Bee. And then they'd have the fighter aircraft. I've just forgotten the name of the particular one. I remember at the moment. But anyway, they would come in and they would...